You're listening to Go Fish with Mike Buck on AM 690, The Fishing Answer. This segment is being brought to you by the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council at wpcouncil.org. Now, troll on in.
Yep, and that's what you're going to be doing, at least for the first few minutes of the program, of the segment today. I was telling you last week and a little earlier today that there's a lot of people concerned about the efforts put through by many to prevent the sale of billfish from Hawaii to anybody, especially to the mainland. And, you know, I think it's because there are other fisheries where certain fish have become really either endangered or gone. And the worry was that that's happening worldwide. Whether or not that's true here in Hawaii is still up for grabs. Eric King was going to be with us today. Among other things, at the council, he is at the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council. Eric's job is in international fisheries and enforcement. And I guess because we'll go around and learn some stuff from Eric on this, marlin and billfish, they don't really know where they are, right? They're just swimming because they're finding food. They don't know if they're in inshore, outshore, American territory, or wide open ocean. They don't know anything.
Well, we know a little bit. Yeah, we know a little bit based on tagging. Mm-hmm. I mean, really, that's the way you kind of understand movements of fish is through tags. And there's been satellite tagging.
Mm-hmm.
So there's some understanding of maybe preferred habitat, water temperature for some species, blue marlin.
But what
marlin.
I was getting at initially is the fish have no idea where they are. They're just swimming and eating.
The fish are swimming and eating, looking and, you know, spawning. Mm-hmm. So they're looking for preferred habitat for both those functions. Really, it's about food and sex, really.
Is it really? I mean, when you break things down, maybe we're like that too in some respect. Exactly. But one thing that I think is clear, and that is that the population is maybe not as understood as other populations because of the big, vast part of the ocean that it occupies.
Yeah, and certainly billfish are among the most highly migratory of those kinds of species. So even more so than, say, yellowfin or, you know,
even big eye. Yeah. But what I think is interesting is maybe they are that way because they're so big. Mm-hmm. They have very few natural enemies.
Yeah.
You know?
They are badass.
Yeah.
Predators, too, you know, very fast.
Okay, so we have had, and I remember when I was a kid, if you caught a marlin, sometimes you'd let it go because it was of no value, because it wasn't oily enough to sashimi, the markets didn't like it, and I remember times when we used to get, way back in the day, 30 cents, 40 cents a pound for marlin, so it doesn't make any sense to go out and catch them, but today it does.
Yeah, and for a few decades now, there's been marlins caught in Hawaii that have been marketed U.S. mainland, and over the last, you know, 4 or 10 years or so, I think the market has really, you know, come to like that fish.
Yeah. Marlin. Well, you know, it's dense, good protein.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not oily, but I think it's mainly even like swordfish. Some of the markets and big restaurants prefer it because it adapts to any sauce they want to put on.
Swordfish, you can do anything with
it.
But I saw marlin in a high-level, like high-end retail market in New York one time, and it was $28 a pound for a fillet, Hawaii marlin.
And that's the one that we used to get all excited at 90 cents. But I think that what's happening is there's a lot of part of our fishery that want marlin tagged because they're charter boats or they're people that, you know, want to go out and use it as, I don't know, as toys, but I mean as trophies. And there's also some that say, well, if you catch a lot of the marlin, the rest of them won't support a charter industry anymore. So I know that some of the pressure is coming from that end of it. But what about a weekend warrior who sells whatever he can catch?
Yeah. So now that weekend warrior, if he caught a marlin and he wants to recoup some of his expenses, maybe not all of it's going home for consumption, he can sell it. But that is going to be sold only in Hawaii. It cannot be exported to any foreign market. It can't be shipped to any U.S. mainland market anymore. So the price that weekend warrior is going to get here in Hawaii is going to be lower.
Oh, of course. But here's the other side of it. And gang, I want you to know that one of the hats that Eric wears is in enforcement in international fisheries, which we'll get to know. But whenever I hear the word enforcement, how would it be enforced? How would somebody even know that you were sending the fish? A contraband fish, if you just put fresh fish and you're shipping it.
Yeah, so that would rely on some inspections.
Yeah.
And that's,
which is nothing set up for that yet, is
you
that,
know,
that I know.
There's some customs and border protection. They are looking at seafood products, especially imports. They do inspect a certain percentage down at the docks. They hold fish if it doesn't have the right documentation.
Mm-hmm. Oh, good.
You know, and there's now a new national traceability requirement, essentially, for the first point of sale into the United States. Imports coming in are required to be documented with where it was caught, what type of vessel, the country of origin, and that's for about 15 to 20 species now.
One of the things, and you can explain how this is by putting on your enforcement hat, is that there's some places that are unscrupulous and they catch everything. And maybe what's happening is they're selling an endangered or protected species, you know, and maybe or else they're not catching and handling it the correct way. So it's coming into our country and it's suspect. It might be injurious to health.
Certainly. I mean, the U.S. seafood market is huge. And so it is good to, you know, have an understanding of how those fish are caught. And, you know, there are a lot of fisheries that are poorly monitored, suspect, and depletions certainly is an issue.
Do people here, Eric, get shocked when you let them know how much of the fish that we eat in Hawaii is not caught by us?
Yeah. You know, but actually here in Hawaii, we catch more seafood than, say, in the continental United States.
Oh, of course, yeah.
So our foreign imports, the stuff that we don't necessarily produce, is around 40%.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the U.S. mainland, they import 90% of seafood.
And of course, per capita, we consume a lot more.
Yeah, twice the national.
Yeah, because it's available.
Yeah.
Okay, so, but what I'm getting at is this whole billfish thing, I know that it keeps coming up, and where is it now? Because it failed. Last year it failed.
Yeah, well, it's law now.
Yeah.
So right now, you know, August 3rd, President Trump signed the Billfish Conservation Act amendment, essentially what it was, and it took away the exemption for Hawaii and the Pacific Insula areas, American Samoa, Guam, Northern Mariana Islands, to sell billfish caught by U.S. vessels into U.S. mainland markets.
Yeah, now with the emphasis being U.S. vessels.
Right.
What about foreign vessels?
Prohibited. That was prohibited since 2012.
Yeah, yeah.
And Hawaii and the U.S. territories had an exemption, and Congress took that away largely at the behest of special interest groups. Like a lot of politics these days, they were influenced by mainly the non-commercial sport fishing sector, you know, and those groups that are associated with sports fishing.
Yeah. In some respects, one guy told me, in some respects, it's good for local people because the fish is going to be cheaper. But it may not be, it's certainly not good for the fisherman because his expenses are the same and his income would be less. However, what are they going to do if they hook a billfish? They're still going to want to sell it, even though it's for less money.
Right. And so then it hurts the fisherman that is fishing, you know. So, and Hawaii seafood consumption relies on its Hawaii fishermen, too. So, It all is going to have an effect, and you know, it's not going to save any more billfish.
Yeah.
Conservation of billfish is not going to be enhanced by this because they're still going to be caught, which is, you know, so from the very first beginning of this Billfish Act, we said it's not going to have a conservation benefit. Really what Congress is doing is allocating fish to certain groups and bypassing the Magnuson-Stevens Act.
Really important that you say that because that the Magnuson-Stevens, by virtue of its existence, needs to be reviewed, what, every decade, every 10 years or so, they have to take a look at it?
Right, yeah. And Congress is in the process of reauthorizing it now, and certainly, as anyone can see, the recent days, politics enters every bit of
every single legislation. Yeah. But, you know, the thing that I'm worried about, and I think this happens a lot, is that, let's say that there was a restaurant in Kansas City that specialized in fresh-caught Pacific blue marlin from Hawaii. Well, he's not going to be able to get that fresh-caught Pacific blue marlin anymore. So he's going to do something else. And there are some that say, well, look, before we just totally criticize those that effectually got this signed into law, they have their own reasons. But I'm thinking that maybe lack of participation by us, by our fishermen, by our listeners, in not voicing their displeasure cost us maybe if there were more opposition and if there were more pushback, and science suggesting that the the, you know, the categories were not endangered, I don't think we'd be where we are. I think we let it sneak up on us and grab us.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's certainly some truth behind that. Mm-hmm. There's also some truth that, you know, there wasn't a lot of support politically in Hawaii our national delegation, congressional delegation.
But I can tell you one thing. Eric from the council is looking at it from their standpoint. They got to deal with all these people. I don't. Yeah. And I can tell you right now that, I mean, we have four congresspeople, and everything that they do is either very supportive or not supportive of things here in Hawaii. And they failed us in the fishing community by not being more vocal about what we are and who we are. And the fact that, unlike people on the mainland, that a lot of us, we don't consider ourselves commercial fishermen, but if you sell one fish a year, you're a commercial fisherman, right?
Right. And, you know, even the Kona guys that are doing, you know, heavy charter activity, those guys are all have CMLs and they sell billfish and it's part of the business, you know, and you're supplying fish to the community.
I remember when some of the charter boats, this one guy is a sign guy, a friend of mine, make up signs, and it says, they were inside the cabins of all of charter boats, this is decades ago, it says, captain and crew fish for, captain and crew survive on fish and tips. Instead of fish and chips, fish and tips. And the reason they said that is they didn't want the tourists to just assume that if you caught a 400-pound marlin, it was your fish. Mm-hmm. It's the boat's fish. Now, most boats, as you know, and I know, they go out, you have a big day, they catch a bunch of mai mai, they're going to cut one up, they're going to give it to the guy, they're going to say, take this back to your hotel, have them cook it up for you, or something. But that's not the issue. If they work for fish and tips, they're out there trying to catch you up an experience, but also to make them a living.
That's right, exactly right. And it's an important part of the fishing industry here in Hawaii, certainly. And just one thing about the Billfish Act, too, you know, the amendment to this year's legislation that was passed, you know, came from a representative from Florida. Mm-hmm. There was national groups supporting this. So it was national sports fishing groups got behind that. And
they are powerful. They have lobbyists, they have money.
You know, so Hawaii, again, the little guy, you know, gets left behind.
Well, okay, now, in that we don't want to make this all doom and gloom. Anything that gets done can be undone. I know it's a lot harder to undo a measure than it is to get one in my opinion. But is there light at the end of the tunnel if somebody was to be able to evaluate something, say, after a year where they could show physically how much financial damage there was to this or that part of the fishery? Do you think there might be or is it going to take another shift in government to even listen to the concerns of people that want it back like the old days?
Yeah, it's a good point. You know, how do you change or undo a bad thing? So, I think the seafood distributors, those that are going to be impacted, have to compile that information and present it to their political representatives. You know,
did the same thing happen with the expansion of the Papahanaumokuakea or the Northwest Islands? Same thing happened. I mean, you know, I don't think that administrators, I don't think they're out to get anybody. I think they listen to the last good argument. And if they have people that are out doing their homework, all they have to do is get a bill. Doesn't matter who writes the bill, who submits the bill, who introduces the bill. You know, here in Hawaii that happens, right?
Right.
Let's say that I have something that's a pet peeve of mine. Well, I can't write a bill and introduce it, but I can go to my local representative and say, hey, this is what I know. And then the guy says, okay, I'll champion. This sounds good. Then he goes in and gets support. Isn't that what happened to us here in many respects?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was you know, a paragraph long bill.
Yeah.
It was just to remove an exemption already provided by Congress recognizing traditional Hawaii markets and jobs. Mm-hmm. So that was a Republican-held Congress in 2012, is my understanding, certainly the House. And, you know, they recognized that this would have an impact in Hawaii. And it's the billfish that are of worry in the Atlantic are different stocks. They have much more poor stock status than Hawaii. And they provided that exemption. And then, you know, 6 years later, it was taken away.
Yeah. You know, it's sort of interesting, gang, if you're just joining us, Eric Kingma is the international fisheries guy for the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council and involved in not just the hearsay, but in the actual science of doing stuff. It's pretty interesting. And international fisheries, for those that don't know, I mean, right now everybody knows that the DLNR handles things coming from the top of the mountain to, you know, 2-3 miles out at sea, and then here comes the council from what to where.
Yeah, 300 to 200 is the U.S. exclusive economic zone, similar for other countries. But the fisheries that we regulate, Hawaii longline fishery, for example, extends its effort into the international waters, mm-hmm. high seas. So our regulations also apply on the high seas.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and therefore, let's get to the enforcement end of things for a minute. Right now, what you're saying is for this act that's become the Billfish Act, mm-hmm. for one of them, let's call it Billfish Act. Whose job is it to enforce whether or not people are living with it? I mean, right now, I don't think we have an overabundance of inspectors right. anywhere.
That's a good question. We're actually asking those same questions to the National Marine Fisheries Service right now. Mm-hmm. So whose responsibility is it? I think it's NOAA OLE has some responsibility. That's the Office of Law Enforcement there. Mm-hmm. There's probably some port inspection, customs, and border protection. Mm-hmm. Those officers are probably involved in that kind of thing. But certainly the amount of enforcement and monitoring you would need is a lot.
I have the opportunity. Right. I have the opportunity to talk to a lot of the enforcement guys just in what I do. And first of all, they're not being overpaid. And secondly, there's not enough of them. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you hope that the guy next to you is like you trying to obey the laws. But if they're not, you know, there's limited consequences because of the lack of just manpower.
Yeah. One thing, too, about the billfish is that, you know, for a couple of decades now, there's been this required billfish certificate of eligibility mm-hmm. paperwork form that Hawaii dealers and you know, wholesalers would have to provide to the next point of sale.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been around forever. So there was an existing mechanism to monitor Hawaii billfish in the marketplace. And the proponents of removing this exemption said there was this loophole. Well, there's no evidence of any Hawaii billfish being sold to the U.S. market that was laundered through Hawaii as foreign or anything like that.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? It was just speculative and really... They were able to convince the powers that be that there was a loophole.
You know what's kind of interesting to me, gang, and I'll get Eric to comment on this, but in my opinion, our fishery is kind of misunderstood. We take it for granted, and we just do. That. I mean, you know, you grow up, you learn how to catch fish, you go over there, catch them, some you eat, some you sell. But in other parts of the Pacific, which Eric operates and the council operates, is that fish, just like everything else, is a commodity. It's like oil or like minerals, or it's like wealth. It's like land. I mean, in some places where you go, if it weren't for fish, there'd be starvation.
Yeah, you don't go to Micronesia and see anyone playing with their fish.
Yeah, exactly.
It is a really highly valued, respected job and position in the community to provide that fish and to the market.
I hope Uncle Roy Morioka's out there, because as soon as he said that, we fish to eat. You know, we don't play with fish. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of guys that what they want to, they want to get a picture or they want to get a mount. They don't eat the fish. They just get a plastic mount and put it up on the wall. Right. But I still think that if enough people become aware of what's just happened, that they can say, wait a minute. Is it, what's next? I mean, you know, if they got the billfish, what next is it going to be? We can't sell Mai Mai to the mainland anymore.
Yeah, I mean, that is a good question, too. What is next for Hawaii fisheries? What do Hawaii fisheries in the future look like?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so in management, getting buy-in from fishermen working together with the community, you know, it's really, really important because, you know, it's so important to the daily fabric of Hawaii lives.
Okay, let's talk about some of the other things that are happening right now. Before we went on the air, Eric and I were talking a little bit about Kona crab and about other things. Every now and again, you do a stock assessment, and that measures a species or how many of them there are, giving you what you can theoretically catch. So I think that we're looking at more catch limits and more closures and more, you know, prohibited areas because if they get they get a few, they get a lot. What's coming up in that? Aren't we a little bit worried about catch limits being discussed and enforced?
Yeah, so we've been developing annual catch limits through the council process for, you know, coral reef fisheries, deep water,
for decades,
fish,
right?
You know, for a while. And we've been doing that only for federal waters. So we're doing these annual catch limits. And really, the state of Hawaii never adopted those catch limits. So when we would set an ACL, it only applied to federal waters, and the state waters could still be open. We are now in the process of only doing a few of these annual catch limits for shared stocks that occur both sort of federal and state waters. So that'd be like the deep water.
I was going to say.
You know, deep seven, the non-deep seven, Uku and others, you know, and then also Kona crab. And some other species, precious coral.
Yeah, now when we talk about Kona crab for a minute, because I know that people that know how to catch Kona crab, they know how to catch Kona crab. Mm-hmm. Most people, if they say, I think I'm going to go catch some Kona crab, they're not. You know, they just, unless uncle goes with them, they're not going to do this. But it would seem to me, and I don't know if science supports it, but is there an abundance of Kona crab?
Yeah, so the Kona crab was just recently assessed, the stock assessment, in-depth comprehensive stock assessment, was just recently conducted by the Pacific Islands Fisheries Science Center and utilizing information, catch log information from the state of Hawaii. And that stock assessment will be presented at our Scientific and Statistical Committee meeting.
That's coming right up.
Coming up in a couple of weeks. Yep. And then also at the council meeting. But it looks good. Kona crab stock status looks good.
Yeah, and sometimes that came as a surprise. Some of you may remember when we did a bottom fish a study a while ago to determine, to take a look at the ACL of the annual catch limits and adjust it downwards for disappearing fish. Turned out the other way around. Did the study show, wait a minute, there's actually, this is, the fishery is a little healthier than we thought, so we actually can increase the limits. I think, see if you think that as a scientist, that the fishing community, my guys, bought into that to the, hey, it's not so bad. You know, in other words, these are not bad guys.
Right.
These are just guys. We're all the same. We all want to be able to eat, to fish, to make money, and yet not hammer the species.
Yeah. So if, you know, if there was a concern before, maybe some guys are like, no, you know, do something else or target ahi or something, you know. But it looks like, you know, the deep seven bottom fish, for example, stock status, better than it's ever been.
Yeah.
You know, the annual catch is 500,000 pounds. The fishery's catching around 250,000. So a lot of room for growth there. You know?
But I know there's some, and this is funny, we'll get your opinion on this. There's a big arm wrestling contest about the protected areas.
Mm-hmm.
And, okay, since they're protected, that would mean there's a lot of fish there. You know, and wait a minute. Since the rest of the stock assessment seems to be pretty good, why don't we unprotect that area for a while so we can go fishing?
Yeah, pretty sure bottom fish swim in and out of those areas.
You bet they do.
It's not like there's this giant reserve of fish on there. And the stock assessment is showing, you know, a very unexploited biomass that could be harvested sustainably.
And incidentally, and we've talked to, once again, I'll mention Uncle Roy and Ed Watamora and a lot of these other guys. If they are, say, they want paka, they have 10 or 15 holes they can go to, and they know not to work a hole too much. Mm-hmm. But because that number seems, I don't know if it's dwindling, the number of serious bottom guys there are, because it's tough to go catch bottom fish, especially with closed areas. If anything, it would look to me like the stock assessments in some of those areas would be getting greater.
Yeah, so there's one stock assessment for those deep seven, and just completed last year, earlier this year, and it's as healthy as it's ever been. So really the council has been pushing for a while for more sort of collaborative management with the state. It does share the catch limit for bottom fish, but the BRFAs are something that we've been recommending removal because the fishermen don't see their need anymore, and the fisheries scientists don't see their need anymore.
Yeah, and by the way, that shows you it's a multi-pronged group. Not all of them are dependent on selling these fish for a living. Not all of them are dependent on eating the fish to survive. And there are some people that just every now and again, and I've got a friend that says, hey, I really feel like, let's go get some uku. You know, let's go get. In other words, you catch them because you can, not because you need to. But I think that some of these burfers are maybe we overdid it to begin with in the first place. There's just too many of them.
Yeah, and I think that the state was trying to respond to you know, stock status or stock assessments back then that were concerning.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so they tried to take their own management of the fishery. You can't fault them for that. But, you know, I think once we learn more about the stock status, the health of fisheries, you got to adapt. And
those of us that are not scientists rely on you guys that use a little bit more facts and figures and less emotion in some of the issues that we talk about. can take a look at something and say, you know, if you keep going to the same old hole year after year and you pull 100 men potsy out of there every day, sooner or later they're not going to be any in there. But if you're the only guy going to that hole in a year, maybe that's not true. Maybe that it is. As often as you come back, it's like going to the supermarket. Just go to the shelf, take what you need, and go home.
That's right. Yeah. But, you know, a lot of guys are smart enough to not just pile on one, you know. And that's fishing. But that's the beauty about fisheries, too, is the replenishment of it.
Okay, so when we talk about the meetings that are coming up, some of the information that's been compiled that we've spoken about, some of these stock assessments and things, do you anticipate some of this is going to be eye-opening for some people?
Maybe eye-opening in the sense that, you know, some of Hawaii's fisheries are lightly exploited, you know, commercially. Deep-water shrimp, for example.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and that's another thing. I haven't talked about them for a long time. Everybody in Hawaii loves shrimp. And every shrimp that we eat in Hawaii mostly is imported, you know, and that's because we either haven't figured out a way to harvest the deep water shrimp or we don't believe they're there.
Well, they're there.
Yeah.
And they're just kind of hard to catch.
You know? Maybe that's why they're there, right? Because they're hard to catch.
Deep water, subject to currents and, you know, the whole range of
them. In the food chain, and we're talking about what size these deep water shrimp?
I think they're the Heterocarpus, the... 6 to 8 inches.
Yeah, they're good size.
I'm a Ebi. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. And that being said, they have a part in the food chain. I mean, they are a significant part of the food chain. So we got to say, all right, before you do that, what do they eat, and who eats them?
I think some of my bottom fishing friends know more. I think a lot of the bottom guys, you know, the deep water snappers are eating a lot of shrimp.
Yeah, well, a lot of them make their flies or their baits or their bait. They'll buy the imported bait, the shrimp, because that's what's going to catch those.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it is interesting though, because somebody said before when they started raising them, remember the kahuku and all of that, and the prawns that they raise here, is why are we doing that when we can go out and develop that fishery?
Yeah.
Maybe it's a little harder to get at.
Yeah, guys have tried, no doubt. Yeah. And you know, it's been hard. Mm. The shelf life, I think, is an issue. Some have tried exporting.
Mm-hmm.
Entry into some foreign markets have been an issue as well.
Yeah. You know what's sort of interesting? If you've never seen an operation, I saw a video on a processing building for shrimp.
Mm-hmm.
Unbelievable. I mean, the amount of shrimp that went in there. But also what was questionable about that is where they were catching them. Because some of these shrimp, I mean, shrimp are garbage disposals, right? They're on the bottom eating who knows what.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're in toxic areas, they may look good, but they may not be that good for you.
Yeah, certainly questions about farm-raised
chemicals, all kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
But when you see the process, I guess it used to be, I remember when people used to catch the prawns here, that cleaning them was an issue, deveining them. These guys... I mean, it's unbelievable, the factories that do that stuff, right?
It's all automated.
Yeah, all automated. It's just unbelievable that this somebody can develop a machine that you can just pour millions of shrimp in, and they come out looking like they've all been manicured. Yeah. All right, so, but once again, the meetings that are coming up, what's coming up next in October?
Yeah, so we got some advisory panel meetings, Hawaii advisory panel, then also around the U.S. territories, Samoa, Guam, Inamai. Our science and statistical committee is meeting in Hilo the week of the 14th, I believe.
And their primary discussion, species discussion, is?
Yeah, they're going to be going over similar agenda items as the council, but setting some annual catch limits for Kona crab, the non-deep seven, the deep water shrimp that we're just talking about, as well as precious corals.
Yeah, and that's another whole other thing. Let's remember that precious corals are part of the industry, part of the fishery.
Yeah, there used to be quite a bit more precious coral harvest, you know, several decades ago, but now it's very little.
Yeah, back in the day, I was a black coral diver a long time ago, and I remember when different gangs and different groups would discover grounds that it took very little time to just decimate it, to take it all. Yeah.
Slow growing.
Yeah, very slow growing, very quick harvesting. Mm-hmm. You know, if you find it, it's gone. But yet, I do know that there are some guys that when the going gets tough, they have to go to another part of the fishery. They might be a bottom fisherman, mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, now we better go get coral. Go diving.
Spearfish, that kind of stuff. Yep.
Okay, so those now when you say these meetings are comprised by whom?
Our science meeting is comprised by pretty preeminent scientists from a lot of different locations, as well as the local territory. So they're fishery scientists, economists, social scientists that meet. And then the council is comprised of the council members. So the council meeting is going to be held in Guam and Saipan the week of the 21st, I believe.
Mm-hmm. The one I wanted to go and MC the Fisherman's Forum so I could get the trip, because it's a lot of fun. A lot of these guys go. You guys go. It is a good time, but that's not the energy is seeing everybody from the far flung areas, right? All being together and sharing concerns.
Yeah, talking about fishing and how important fishing is to Hawaii and the U.S. Pacific Island territories.
Yeah, and that being said, one more thing, and maybe you can explain this a little bit aside of what Eric and I usually talk about. But I think over the last few years, people have embraced the fact that we have our own indigenous ahi in Hawaii, in the main Hawaiian Islands. And I think that a lot of times, almost everybody thought that ahi are the ones that are motoring along with the big eye, and that they visit Hawaii and they keep moving along. I think the evidence more than supports science saying, no, we have our own ahi, and they're born here, and they raise here, and they get up to 100 pounds, and they get caught here.
That's right. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. They're born here. Yeah. Spawned here. Spawned in right offshore waters every summer.
And the other thing is, maybe you can answer this, because we all know that we're waiting for the big eye runs all the time. It doesn't seem to me that they run with little babies, but the babies have to be somewhere. You know, when the big eye are running, you know, and the market's full of them, you don't see little ones.
Yeah.
I mean, you see a lot of little shibi here caught locally, right? Mm-hmm. But
when the big eye running, I mean, yeah, maybe the small ones are not there.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think that they're in shallower waters, gaining strength and gaining size. I think that's pretty cool. And one of the things that that Eric and I were talking about earlier is a lot of what we talk about is up on the web, and they're working hard to make the Western WPCouncil.org website more functional and more informative. But those of you that are teachers, if you've listened to anything that Eric and I have been talking about and you want to explain to your keiki what's going on this, there are some really great materials that are free that you can get hooked up with the council. And I think that's part of the mission of the council, isn't it? Right. Is to educate people.
Yeah, education and outreach.
Yeah, and so that's what this part of our program is all about. And we want to make sure that you are part of that. So in recapping what we were talking about, some of the information, you mentioned there's several studies that have just been completed that are now going to go forward to the next round of discussion, saying, okay, this is science. Yeah. Here's the science. Now how are we going to deal with either changing, expanding, or contracting what we're doing?
Yeah, so we have a process for all that. We get new stock assessments. Mm-hmm. They get reviewed, peer-reviewed, reviewed again, and then that information goes to the managers, council, and they make decisions based on a process. And if it's, what the stock assessment provides, then there's different measures you can apply.
Okay, in just a few short weeks from now, and in the next couple of weeks, I'll be announcing my picks for political office, and that based strictly on you, on the fishery. And some of these people, by the way, and this is your job, some of the people that we are looking at electing, and some of the people that are already elected looking for, in being reelected, they don't know about the fishery. And if you don't tell them, they'll never know. And if a vote goes around on the floor of the Senate or the House and they don't know about it, and they'll just ask somebody else, what do you think? And they'll vote the way somebody else thinks, maybe instead of the way you think. And I want to end up on the note. Eric Kingman and I first started talking about the Billfish Act. I want to make sure that you understand out there exactly what's happened. So we call this the Billfish Act, but what does it actually mean? I go out trolling tomorrow and I catch a 265-pound marlin, and I want to call my friend in San Francisco to see if his buddy that has a restaurant at Fisherman's Wharf wants to buy it.
Can't do it.
Can't do it. Yep.
Yep. It's against the law. So now you got to rely on selling that fish local market, and your neighbor might have caught one too.
Yeah.
And the price is going to be lower.
Every now and again, if those of you that if you and there's another thing. maybe we ought to back up on this for a minute too and get Eric on thought on this. It used to be that if you caught a marlin, you could throw it in your truck or take it on your trailer in your boat and go down to the fish agency and drop it. Mm-hmm. And now they want that fish to the core temperature coming into that building mm-hmm. colder than what you could get it fresh from the ocean. Mm-hmm. So a lot of these guys are getting less money and they're building a big fiberglass box in their driveway or in their garage and they're having to put that fish in ice and drop the core temperature for a day before yep. they even bring it to the market.
Yeah, so you lose some, you know, freshness there.
Yeah, yeah.
But really, on the market side, those temperatures are pretty stringent and required to ensure, you know, food safety.
And food safety means, by the way, if you want to be safe in catching that fish and selling it again, when you go to the polls and do your election in November, you better know that whoever you're voting for has a little bit of simpatico about your fishery. And I don't know if there's a way, and I'm certainly not trying to put words in Eric King's mouth, but I think that some of this that's gone on about these billfish is it's a real shame to a lot of people here, and it's about relationships. I know a guy, for instance, that has three mainland restaurants, and they rely on his quality. They know he's a good fisherman, so he'll call them up and say, "I got marlin," and they'll say, "Give me 50 pounds, give me 100 pounds, give me 80 pounds."
Yeah, and it's going to be affecting small businesses too. Look at the guys that were doing, you know, the jerky, the smoked marlin jerky, packaged in stores across the country, large stores, you know, and those markets
that are counts too, right?
I mean, everything billfish processed from fresh fillets to jerky to any kind of dip or anything.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh boy, there you go. Hey Eric, thanks very much. And if you want to find out more about what Eric and the council are doing, go to WPCouncil.org. WPCouncil.org. And hey, by the way, thanks for the recent music submissions. I get a kick out of those songs from today. And once again, if you want to know and not become one of the rules of the road people, get down to POP, upstairs, Marine and Life Raft Safety, and get that e-perb I was talking about, right? And if you have something you want to hear on the program, drop me a line, themikebuckshow@gmail.com. themikebuckshow@gmail.com. And if you want to talk to somebody in the council, it's easy. Go to wpcouncil.org. That's your homework. wpcouncil.org. See you next time.